Welcome to Grumpy Strategist Makers Series. It's been a little while since we've done one, but I'm absolutely delighted with the guest that we have for you today. We've got Steve Baxter, the head of Beaten Zone Ventures, which is a fantastic new entrant into the defence firmament, but with a whole lot of experience out of service in the Australian Army and then in the tech world, a successful businessman who's now turned his business experience, his military experience, and his own money towards the problem of how to equip Western militaries much more powerfully, much more quickly, with fantastic technology and systems out of Australia. So, Steve, it's my pleasure to have you on the program. I've been watching Beaten Zone from a distance, so great to clap eyes on you up in Brisbane. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me, Michael. Pleasure.
So, Steve, just your background very quickly. So you joined the Royal Australian Army, or the Australian Regular Army.
So I joined the Army at in 1987, at 15 years old, as an Army apprentice, 42nd class.
Right. Just as Paul Dibb did the white paper. Yep.
Yeah, it was about that time, to be honest. That's right.
Yeah.
Beasley was Defence Minister, from memory.
Yep.
Joined up as an electronics technician, finished up as a guided weapons technician in Adelaide at the 16th Air Defence Regiment, working on Rapier and RBS 70. An average of one missile a year. It wasn't exactly an exciting time to be in the military.
Well, too, the RBS 70 had a long, long career long after that, didn't it?
I believe they're still yeeting them off in Ukraine, to some success as well, which is great. I just prior to the end of my service career signed up on a 9-year contract. What's worse than recruiting a 15-year-old? Getting a 15-year-old to sign a 9-year contract.
Yeah, that seems like a lifetime when you're signing that one.
It was. I'm glad I did it. Obviously, you should never look back if you're happy where you are now. I ended up starting a dial-up a business from home, from an Army married quarters. We had a dial-up internet service provider in Adelaide. That went quite well. I ended up discharging from the Army when it was sort of taking off.
Mm-hmm.
Ran that for 5 or so years in Adelaide. Sold that in 2000, or sold the last part of it in 2000 to Aussie Mail. Moved back to Brisbane.
The famous Aussie Mail.
Aussie Mail, that's it. Moved back to Brisbane in 2000. Caught up with an old schoolmate, and we started another business called Pipe Networks in Brisbane. We were a wholesale version, I suppose, of my first business. It was probably not the best description, but we built metro fiber cables, submarine fiber, data centers, and some other sort of related products. We listed that business on the ASX in 2005, and we sold that in 2010. And since then, I've been primarily an early stage investor in primarily Australian software businesses.
And a bunch of people would know your name and face from Shark Tank.
Yeah, I think there's 4 or 5 people watched it. So, that was a great 4 years, to be honest. And that's what probably got me on this military journey. 2 years, I did 4 seasons on Shark Tank. And 2 years into that, Army, actually a chap called Kieran Joyce, who's now Air Force. Kieran's a fantastic human, approached me and asked me to become involved with Army Innovation Day in Canberra. And I did that. And I suppose they sort of let me inside the tent. And I was just staggered in a good way with what I saw, was what industry was developing, and just the range of technology. And that's when I also saw what happened next was they were, through various means, through defence grants, mostly through DIH, but some other mechanisms at the time, they were building this capability. And then it was just literally dying on the vine. It entered this weird sort of period. You know, in commercialization, there's a term called the valley of death, where it takes a while from prototype completion to market acceptance. Well, in defence, it's a chasm of death because nothing gets out of the chasm.
Well, you know, I've watched those programs for years, and I find them intensely frustrating. You know, the Army Innovation Days, the Navy One Autonomous Warrior down at Jervis Bay, because what seems to me to happen is you get these really motivated Australian creators and inventors with out of medium and small companies. They think they've got answers to the military's problems. They do. They turn up at these demonstration days with a little bit of grant money out of something like ASCA or the Army or the Air Force or the Navy directly. They demonstrate and they can turn up for a few years and improve what they're doing, show that they could actually solve a military problem. And then as soon as that happens, quick as a flash, defense buys none of their product. So, you know, my line on it, we were talking about this before the show, my line on these defence innovation programs and demonstration days is they're a wonderful way for Australian taxpayer money to develop prototypes that other militaries can then acquire. And good news, they're being used in places like Ukraine very effectively now. but they're not being used by our military.
Well, I think the good news is that if it manages to get the US military, it'll boomerang back to Australia, because the easiest way to get the ADF to use it is to sell it to a Yank and come back with a funny accent, right? So, look, that is – not every innovation should get success. So, I mean, I was at a conference in the US where someone mentioned that their equivalent type program is called CIBA programs.
Small Business Innovation.
Yeah. They were saying only 8% of those go into further funding, and I thought that was high. I thought, well, that's that, they were saying, oh, it's depressingly low, and I thought, geez, that's quite high. I thought if it was one in, I thought it was maybe 3 or 4%, it would have been a good outcome.
It's not a bad success rate, actually.
Yeah, well, that's further funding. I'm not too sure it gets commercial success. Also, right. They go into that next stage of funding.
Yeah, that's
not too bad, because not everything should work. I mean, I'm a venture guy. We operate by something called the power law sort of return, mm-hmm. Where we have one, in a portfolio of sort of 15 to 20, we have one or two knockout of the park successes that give us pretty well all of our returns.
So, well, yes.
We used to lots of things dying, you might say.
Yeah, I think that's the attitude that you do not see in government. I get people in government saying, oh, we're going to take more risk. But for them, taking more risk is only having a 75% level of confidence that their particular thing is going to pan out. Not a 1%, but if it does, it's terrific.
The Army actually made a mistake of putting a panel at Army Innovation Day in Perth a couple of years ago. Just after ASCA was formed, Emily Hilda was on stage. I think the Special Forces General guy was the MC, so if you played up, he was going to murder you on the spot, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a Navy guy there, and there was a lawyer, and I don't know. Anyway, I was last to get introduced. And then Emily Hilda was just before me. She said, I'm, Emily, I'm Emily from the new ASCA, we're out to take risk. And I was introduced. Yep. I had to put my hand up and said, so in that risk, how much are you prepared to lose? And she said, oh, no, it's a different sort of risk.
Yes.
And literally in the audience, in this massive auditorium, every head just looked up.
Yeah.
My phone in my pocket, which was on silent, just started going. My WhatsApp just had 400 messages on it afterwards saying, what are you saying?
It's a shot duck. From that moment, it's a shot duck, isn't it? I remember hearing the head of CASG, the current head of CASG, early in his tenure. He said, look, a lot of people have said to me, Chris, we need a revolution in the way defense procures capability. We need a revolution. The current system is broken. I said, after a careful look at it, no. They're wrong. We need an evolution, not a revolution. And when he said that, I had that same sinking feeling that anyone hearing Emily's remark to you would have had.
And I suppose the reason that I've gone down the road of Beaton's Own Venture Partners and private capital is I'm an investor, right? So to me, everything, to a hammer, everything was like a nail, right? So mm-hmm. I'm that investor hammer. But I'm a huge believer in what private capital can do in early stage innovation. And we have a good demonstration of this. So back in the early 2009, 10, 11 type period, which is probably when the Australian tech startup scene in general really started to get going. Mm-hmm. What happened then was there was a few tax rule changes that allowed lots and lots of private investors to come in. So there was lots of people coming in taking incentivized bets on lots of different things, most of which didn't work. But the ones that did work were actually doubled down on. So it built this natural funnel. And out of that, you get the likes of Canva and Safety Culture and all the other businnesses that are out there.
Yeah.
So
what was the tax change? You mentioned.
There was a tax scheme called, it's a terrible name, ESVCLP, Early Stage Venture Capital Limited Partnership. Mm-hmm. Essentially, investors we're an ESVCLP. Investors get a 10% tax credit on money invested and capital gains tax free on the way out. The downside is you can't claim losses. And I'll paraphrase this by saying, everyone who's listening, get your own tax advice.
Yes. But.
But that's generically the scheme. So that, and then in 2016 or 17, Malcolm Turnbull introduced something in the NISA program. National Innovation Science Agenda introduced something called the ESIC, lots of terrible acronyms, Early Stage Innovation Company. But that's the angel investor version of that one I just mentioned. So there, angel investors get a 20% tax credit, or gains tax free, but it's capped at no more than, you can invest no more than $1 million a year, essentially, or get a $200,000 benefit per year.
And again, nothing for losses. So you've still got to put your money at risk.
Yeah. No one
has it. If it comes off, your return gets an advantage tax treatment.
Yeah, but we just don't do this for losses. If you're in this game to ride a loss, go to the horse races. Do something else.
Well, it's back to the ASCA comment, isn't it? You've got to be prepared to lose a whole lot of your money to have the wins.
And for me, and I've had to do a lot of analysis, and I've written some articles. I've had to sort of, when you know things in your gut, and you're trying to actually put smarter words around it, I suppose. I didn't finish high school, for Christ's sake, so I'm not exactly gifted with words. But I looked at, and I mentioned before, a bit of a libertarian fan of some of the Austrian school, but Friedrich Hayek, the economist, he has the concept of the information problem, where information in any system is widely held and thinly distributed, and therefore no one expert can do it all. You need groups. You need larger networks of people making decisions in a free market, and that's what private capital does. So it's not an anointed academic and a couple of ex-flag officers sort of telling young people how to fight the future wars because they think they know technology. Because if they get that right, I'll sell them a battleship, for Christ's sakes.
That's how dumb
that sort of statement is. So it's a bunch of people at the bottom end making incentivized decisions. If they make the wrong one, it hurts them. It's their own capital, or it's capital that they've been tasked to look after with an incentive.
Yes, yes.
It's not a public servant who's gotten some money through a committee, through a budget, who got it from a taxpayer.
Yeah, and they have nothing personally at stake, do they?
Nothing at all.
Except losing the money and therefore being risk averse. Yeah.
No one's been fired for that in the government. No. So it doesn't really matter either, right? So whereas, if you lose investors' money, they won't give you a second lot.
Yeah.
Tell you. So make these bets. So my goal, I'd like to see, and Beaten Zone is about returning multiples of invested capital to my investors. I'm personally investing $6 million into Beaten Zone, into the fund, and there's a lot more to get the business going on top of that. So that's my goal. So I'm a huge fan that you're the business or a charity, and the two shouldn't meet.
Yes, I agree.
But I do think if we can demonstrate a better way to do this, one of the versions of success I see for myself and I see for the sector is if we can have, let's say, scores, maybe hundreds of early stage investors making one or two bets a year in the defence space. Australia's a small economy, defence is even smaller.
Yep.
Right? So it's not massive to start with. But if we can get, let's say, 100, 150 angel style early stage investors making on average one or two bets a year, right? That's huge. That is really big, right?
How much do they need to be partly driven by patriotism? Because I'm with you, it has to be about business and a commercial return. But to actually even be interested in the defence sector, I've seen you write some stuff about the ESG framework that businesses have and how actually defence is the missing limb in that. I think your argument's similar to mine when I'm asked, why do I work on anything to do with defence? So I once got introduced at a party as... this is my friend. He's from the harm sector. He's from the harm industry. And there was this deathly silence. And I looked around. I said about the person who said it to me, look, I'm very pleased that Peter introduced me this way because I do what I do so they can say things like that in a free society and not get arrested. So defence is not seen as something for a lot of people to invest in.
Look, I think ESG is a lost cause. I mean, I've got lots of sayings. ESG hate us, we hate them. We call it a draw and move on, to be quite honest. To be honest, how such a beautiful first world concept as ESG
that
only exists in a robust Western democracy.
Yeah, it's a very luxurious concept.
Robust Western democracies are defended by robust men carrying heavy things.
Yeah. So is part of what you're doing driven by the way the world looks to you at the moment? My view is it's actually a much more dangerous world than it was 10 and 20 years ago.
You've just got to go to an arms conference overseas and know that the drums are beating. And I just hope we've got diplomats who are smart enough to pull this thing up before it actually goes. That's my big concern. I think that you don't want the tail to wag this dog, right?
Mm.
But so I'll bring it back to, if this is an American podcast, I'd be saying it different. I'd be saying, yes, it's all about patriotism. Isn't that great? Mm. In Australia, no, it's all about, and I'm serious on this. I'm out to return multiples of invested capital back to my investors. That is, if you invest $1 million in me, I want to get you back $2, 3, 4, 5, 6 million. That's my goal.
Yeah.
So, because if you do that, then I can do my second fund, my third fund, my fourth fund, my fifth.
Yes. Right. And maybe others will do a similar thing and Australian and partner security will benefit. But I think another interesting thing, looking at your model, is you're not actually focused on selling to the Australian defence customer.
No, I think they're a lot. I think they're a write-off. Australia's a small market. So look, in all my startup investing, it's always been attack the biggest, easiest market.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at in terms of the allied addressable market. That is, there's roughly 50 nations we can sell things to that we have some sort of defence cooperation with that we can sell things to probably without being arrested as a gun runner. That's prior to the 2% going to 5 or 3.5%, that was about $1.7 trillion. Yes, $1.7 trillion. Excuse me.
That escalates markedly with the NATO decision. Yeah,
they'll go to 2.5 to 3 in the next decade at the very least. It's a big market there. Yeah. So there's a large capacity. So there's 50 nations there. Like, and I think to a point you made before in our pre pre-podcast chat about the single customer. There's 50 nations out there. Every nation's got an Army, Navy, Air Force. God bless America. They've got Marines, Space Force, and Coast Guard as well. Every one of those has their own version of a Special Forces who has their own purchase officer who just can ignore purchasing rules and buy your thing if they think it's shiny enough. Basically, you know, that's overgeneralizing.
Well, except for Australia. I don't think we do have that person who's about. Well, our Special Forces in a tiny way, yeah.
A lot lower. I mean, yeah. Doug Beck, head of the US Defense Innovation Unit, last year, I mean, earlier this year, was quoted as saying that inside the US DOD, there's 265 organizations with that short form purchasing ability. It's called OTA, Other Transaction Authority.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I don't know how many survived DOGE. You know, if it's still triple digits, I'm pretty happy.
Well, and also, I would say one thing that Pete Hegseth is doing is trying to do more of that.
Oh, and he has been such a brilliant, I mean, love or hate him. I don't really care about his personal politics and his personal life, but the executive orders have come out. So the fourth one just came out recently. The first one was around, I think it was around naval shipbuilding, I want to say.
Yep.
There was one around software acquisition, which is, that will be miraculous when it comes off. There was another one around general purchasing. And the one I recall, it was quite a long one. The statement I recall in there was basically, if your project's more than 20% late or 20% over budget, you have like 45 days to explain why we don't cancel it.
Yes, like, yes. With the default being it's dead.
Yeah. You lay down the law, you're right.
Yeah.
And the latest one was around drones, the drone initiative, which was last week, the week before. This is mid-July 2025. So it was last week, the week before. So I think that's good. They're trying. They are really trying.
Well, and also he was out on the lawn outside the Pentagon signing it, surrounded by American military folk flying drones around him. And in fact, one of them brought him the document down. He grabbed it from the drone. So, I mean, I'm with you.
Takes were involved in that one.
Yeah, probably. But he was trying to make a symbolic point about actually this is changing. And I love the way he did that.
He's a fantastic communicator. I mean, he had that Fox background. He's a fantastic communicator as well as being, you know, a junior officer at the same time. But so they're definitely trying to do things better. And under the sort of AUKUS frameworks in the last sort of year or so, in November last year, there was a bunch of work done out of the embassy in Washington around liberalising, I call it liberalising ITAR,
but yeah.
Export control is liberalising ITAR. So there's been a whole bunch of stuff done that makes it easier to do business as an Australian in the US. Now, it's not easy, but it's easier.
Well, but the counterpoint to that, and we had a bit of a chat about this earlier, is the America First theme where, well, you know, I don't care if other people do it. I want it done here. I'd like to make iPhones here.
It's always been the same, though.
What's your thought about that?
You'll never get a lot. Even prior to the Liberation Day, whatever you want to call it, you were never going to get a lot. It would be exceptionally rare if you had a large US military contract to not have to make or at least final assemble of the damn thing in the US. That's always. And honestly, that's what we should do in Australia. I can't fault their policy. It's frustrating. I can't fault their policy, to be honest. But if you're a business who had a really good thing and you were selling to, let's say, more of a global market, right? Now, we're a very good place. We're a very good polity to domicile to design and prototype things. We have the R&D tax concession. We have pretty good industrial policy around that, to be honest. And that's it's quite stale. It's been around for a while. So that's great. But if you're looking at where the cheap things to make things are, it's never here.
No.
I mean, if you're a sensible businessman, you'd be saying, okay, we're not going to make this in China for obvious reasons, but where else in the allied world can we make this? And then you'd start, then honestly, the US is probably, it's at least a lower cost manufacturer than Australia.
So than here.
It would be in the consideration universe as a manufacturer anyway.
Yeah, and you also might be closer to your bigger market as well, mightn't you? So, I mean, interesting, you're saying something I've heard lots of smart business people involved in defence business say, which is, I will sell everywhere else before Australia buys it. And just on the maths, you're right, it's a much bigger market. But frankly, it is a bit of an indictment of our own defence organisation and its behaviour that these powerful solutions are adopted by everyone else, and only when that happens do they get interested.
Okay, so let's not be too down on defence, to be honest, in this. So I've been in this space. I've been in the early stage investing space for some time, 15 years now, as it turns out. It feels long. And the one thing I will avoid is any Australian software business, for example, who has designs to sell to Rio, BHP, Woolworths, any large Australian corporate. Let's not call it any large Australian corporate. Large Australian corporates are very hesitant to buy from small Australian companies.
Yep.
I mean, they will do it. You know, so I'm talking generalities here. So large US companies don't care where it comes from. They probably prefer to support a startup. So there's a cultural issue there. So it's not just defence. I'd say.
Yes. So, you know, but the you're right. You're right. It's more about the Australian economy and the whole business and government sector. I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have yeah. some cultural issues about supporting smaller businesses, to be honest, which is a shame. It is worse, however, in defence, but it's not defence by itself by any stretch.
No. So you talked about there are some reasons that Australians and Australian businesses don't help themselves succeed. And you were contrasting that with America in our chat. And one of them was interesting, which was sometimes we're just too slow.
Yeah, we're very slow. Look, I don't really call it. I'm trying to write an article that's got less expletives in it because it's something that annoys the hell out of me. You know, we're currently working with some businesses trying to get them networked into the US. You know, we're seeing Australians taking days to respond to an email to then line up a meeting in weeks, if not a month away. Now, the US competitor trying to get that investor or business's attention will reply in 10 seconds, have a meeting tomorrow.
Yeah, so, yeah, which just shows they're interested, they're on the game, ready to go, yeah.
We have a really fantastic chap, Sean Singleton. He's our US venture partner. He was ex-US Air Force, DIU, Defence Innovation Unit. And he has a great saying, which is that the US Department of Defence doesn't buy the best technology. It buys the best technology you can get on contract.
Right.
So that's a big call statement, right? So you've got to get there. Now, the hesitation I see with Australian companies is they're very hesitant to sell their equity. And in the US, how you actually buy friends in that market is you get them to invest in your business. You get them to invest, essentially. So they're incentivized. So
you don't want to hold it all to yourself. Realize that to be successful, you've got to share some of it.
Yeah. They'll walk you into all these other businesses and all these other opportunities because they've got skin in that game, right? Do you want to own, you know, in the end, 90% of, you know, of a $10 million business, or you want to own 40% of a $1 billion business?
Yeah.
That's the scales we're talking about, if you know what I mean. So the hesitancy to let go in that respect, the lack of urgency. When I was in the army, we always got beat around a stick. The sense of urgency. They're really lacking in this space, to be honest. Once again, I'm talking generalities. I'm sure there's people out there who do this well. I'm yet to meet them. So the other one is they don't cooperate in that.
The
funding mechanisms in the past have been mostly through non-dilutive grant funding, which, you know, if you don't like selling equity is great, but, you know, the grants tend to be too little, too late, delivered over too long a period.
But then that incentivizes behavior where I can't share the grant. There's not enough for two of us, so I got to get it all. So it's a kind of winner takes all approach, isn't it?
I call it funding by Hunger Games. Everyone's trying to murder each other for the pot of gold.
Yeah, so, even if it's not a very big pot. Yeah.
And as a result, the cooperation level's low. And that's a small thing. It's not a material thing. It's bordering on material for the sector. You know, so it's a 5 or 10% sort of efficiency improvement if you get it right.
So I've seen, I mean, your business is all about realizing there's a whole lot of capability in startups and small creative enterprises. And you're sort of investing in them to then bring them to these bigger market opportunities. So part of your business must be actually a real sense of optimism because you see the creativity and capacity in Australian business.
Well, yeah, no shortage of it. So we've since started, I think we've got close to $400 million in Aussie opportunities in our pipeline, for example. So we've pulled apart the market quite substantially. It's pleasantly shocking what I've seen on this journey, to be honest. But one of the more pleasant realizations is space. We are really good in space. And I'm not talking about launches, and you know, all the best. I hope Gilmore goes well when they do that next.
But
talking about like space comms, space domain awareness, space guidance, space propulsion. We have positioning, a lot of the quantum stuff. We have some amazing space opportunities. That's been really quite refreshing, to be quite honest. So yeah, we see a lot of great businesses out there.
There's a lot of dual use in some of that, isn't there? Like all of those technologies you just mentioned, there are clear military and defence applications for all of them.
Yeah, I think our entire pipeline, we only have one business that has no dual use aspect to it at all, and it's a guided weapons business. And guided weapons are good for nothing but putting a big smoke out on the other person.
Yes. Even the most ruthless business competitor is not allowed to use a guided weapon on their competitor.
Not yet. We'll see how much the global order dissolves. What do you reckon?
Yeah.
So, and our thing is around dual use. Beaton Zone's essentially a cynical anti-ESG fund. We not only invest in sovereign Australian businesses, we invest in sovereign Australian businesses with applicability to lethality and survivability.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
My job as an investor is really simple. I buy low and sell high.
Yeah.
That's when you cut it down. Right now, a lot happens before you buy and a lot happens before you sell.
Yeah.
But that's essentially it. So how do I get the best buy price for an asset? Irrationally unloved assets are the best things that you can find. And in ESG and other issues, you can't find any more irrationally unloved asset than a defense asset.
Well, and it's an asset that's become much more important, as we see with the wars that are taking place on our planet and the heavy amount of militarization we see in the country our Prime Minister's visiting right now.
And if you want to... So, in order to get the best price, you drive away as many other investors as you possibly can. So your gold is worth more than the equity. So
and if they're busily driving themselves away because they think it's a bit icky, then they're doing their job for you.
Which is why we use the horrible L word, the lethality word. No investor wants to be near that. Things that hurt people, whereas somewhat it's a requirement for us to be. We don't want that. I'm a dad and I'm an ex-soldier. I've got mates who are still serving. It's the last thing I want. But in trying to get the best buy side, and we're about to need a lot of these things. The reality is that militaries don't stop the enemy with harsh language alone. You need a robust man carrying something heavy.
Well, also, one theme I'm interested in is we also need a diversity of military capabilities. You know, this idea that the answer to every problem is to buy something from the catalogue of a big American company. There are three big problems. Is America politically reliable? Well, hopefully so when the chips are down. Is it reliable in a material supply sense? In other words, do they have the production capacity to meet their needs and then ours as a priority customer in a time of crisis? Probably not. They're telling themselves they can't meet their own needs. We've just seen the Pentagon's slow delivery of missiles and other consumables, not just to Ukraine, but to every customer, while they look at have they got enough for the American military. And then the third problem is if everybody's using the same system, your adversary only has to defeat one system. So you're all firing the same missile. Countermeasures to the one missile are effective against them all. We're far more powerful as a bunch of allies if we bring different systems to the conflict, as well as some core common ones.
No, 100% agree. I mean, I'm not too sure if you've seen my email signature, Michael, but I have a little PS in there, which is PS. If you're contacting me in order to try and change the ADF's way of doing business, forget about it.
Right. Right.
I don't have time to burn on the conversation because I'm a pilot as well. I fly small aircraft.
Yeah.
Every pilot loves to get a group of pilots together and they're bound to complain about CASA.
Yeah.
You feel pretty good, but you've achieved nothing.
Yes.
And then we can all complain about the ADF and CASG. It all feels really good, but we've achieved nothing.
I'm with you on that. And, there's something going on now about Richard Miles has realised that maybe the defence bureaucracy is not humming like a top. You know, I think it was things like the audit office revealing that the Navy surface fleet is broken and has been broken for a long period of time. So he's talking about streamlining and reorganising the organisation. I don't know. My view is that is a busted flush in many ways. It'll just be shuffling things around, making things slightly better, editing and polishing the big processes. There's a really interesting example I've seen you write about, which is if you want rapid innovation that increases military power, you need to get back to some market principles.
Yeah.
Like what you were talking about with libertarianism, it's letting a larger number of decision makers who have some resources make some decisions and deal directly with suppliers. And you also, and that is the opposite to the direction defense as an organization has gone in. It's gone to more hierarchy and more centralization of bigger, slower processes. So if you wanted to change it, I think you'd do the opposite. You'd leave the big process clunk on its way because I'm with you. It's like complaining about CASA. Build a separate market-based fast machine that delegates to the young people who are going to do the war fighting, give them buckets of money to acquire from companies that have potential solutions and let them work together. But you've got an example where that's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah, back 20 years ago, I read a book called The Clue Train Manifesto. So, the clue train is leaving the station, get on board. And it was actually a series of theses put together in 1999-2000 by a variety of authors around larger businesses have to get into the online marketplace, start listening to customers, understand that, marketplaces, these online forums are marketplaces for ideas, conversations, about how hyperlinks subvert hierarchies, about how these really innovative software mechanisms subvert hierarchy. So, thinking about bureaucracy, subvert bureaucracy. And then recently, I think in May this year, it became openly known regarding the Ukrainian Brave One online marketplace, which is like a Temu for weapons, let's say.
Temu for the warfighter,
Complete with feedback and gamification. And to me, they just encompass so much of the clue train. And so as an amazing example where you've shortened innovation cycles and you can basically get capability in the hands of people using it, get feedback straight away, request feature upgrades, et cetera, et cetera. And they've overlaid gamification, which is quite macabre.
I'm going to put a link to your article with this podcast, but but it's got this really interesting incentivized reward structure, doesn't it? Like, if you kill a Russian tank, you get 60 points. If you kill a Russian drone, you get 80 points. If you kill something on a motorcycle or a drone operator, you get this. And when you get these points as the Ukrainian service person on the front line, you then get to use those. That's your currency to purchase systems.
Yeah, so buy innovation from the marketplace, use it, score more points, buy more stuff.
You buy it direct on this system from the company. And you could also have feedback to that company about, actually, the reason I was able to kill that Russian tank with 3 of these instead of 70 is this is what it did really well. I'd like more of that. And so it's not just a market-based procurement, rapid procurement. It's a market-based product development machine.
It's the real life, and it's a real life, and but you're being used in a military context. I mean, you might want to mark this part in your time frame, because part of that, which I didn't put in the article, is what they did when they changed the scoring value for a Russian KIA.
Yeah.
So they tripled the score, the points for a confirmed Russian KIA, and double the KIA were reported. Now that's exceptionally macabre. Don't get me wrong, but it's warfare. Let's face it, none of it's pleasant. But talk about incentive. I mean, was it Charlie Munger? Show me an incentive and show me the outcome, I'll show you the incentive, right?
Well, I suppose, warfare is the ultimate driver of incentives, isn't it? Hmm. So, but to actually capture it in this system, think about it in Australia, I think it would actually also start to solve the recruitment and retention problem. Because one of the most disempowering things, I think, about joining our military and our defence department right now is you know that you're not going to have any decision-making authority until you get to a senior rank. You know, not a colonel anymore. You've got to be a brigadier. Not an EL2 who's being paid, $150,000. You've got to get into the senior executive service. You've probably got to be promoted a couple of times in the senior executive service before you get any decision-making rights. And that is hugely demotivating. I don't know about you, but when I look at technology, people like me in their 50s are not at the bleeding edge. We are Zimmer frame technologists compared to the actual people that would be doing the fighting. And the Ukrainian people that are using this Brave One system are in their 20s. They're not in their 50s. So if we could delegate a small bucket of money down to junior people in our military and wrap them up with a system like Brave One, they would be buying products that companies you're investing in make.
I don't disagree. And I think it doesn't need a great deal of thinking either, to be honest. Over the years, I think DIH had a budget of about $90 million a year for around the roughly decade, 7 mm-hmm. years. Or whatever it
was. Well, ASCA, the Capability Accelerator, is meant to have $3.5 billion over 10 years. So that's enough money to do something serious with.
Well, they fund a lot of things. So therefore, there's a lot of pre-qualified stuff that could go straight into this online shop. So everything that's ever received a dollar of government grant funding, good or bad, who cares? Let's get the feedback, because it might be good. It might be bad right now, but needs one tweak to make it good.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And if you've got a warfighter who's using it and able to tell them what the tweak would be, you've got a virtuous circle there, haven't you?
And also, you have to then enable the service units to be able to break it. So yes. In the army, I had to do a loss and damage report on a $10 bush hat, for Christ's sake. You know what I mean? Let's hope that's changed.
Well, you shouldn't have done that to the hat, frankly, Steve.
It was a funny story about the hat, let me tell you. But anyway, but give them full authority. Like this stuff, this is written off. As soon as it hits your unit, it's written off. You guys, you'll need to do a report, understand that. Do a report, how did it work, what did it do? But you have full authority to destroy this thing, but just do something cool with it.
Well, this is the idea of consumables, isn't it? When I look at the military, like I joined the Defence Organisation in 1993 as a graduate. And I remember there was a time there was no money and everybody had to look after everything really, really well. It was like, you bought something, you got to keep it for years. Well, that's true for multi-billion dollar systems like an F-35. But smaller stuff, it's disposable consumable. It's like... in the rest of our lives, we accept that, don't we? Like, I'll buy a new one. It broke, I'll buy a new one. And that's the mindset, I think, that would enable this Brave One approach in defence.
And just prior to the election, I wrote an article because I was so tired of reading these stories about, but if we did actually increase the defence budget, we possibly couldn't spend it. Fix that problem, but that's probably unfixable. But okay, so if we have to, should you be judged on your defence capability by your percentage of spend on GDP. It's a measure, so let's just that's an argument, but it's a measure. Let's just stick with it. It's one common measure. So that how do we rapidly increase that without, you know, doing a new production line for F-35s? Well, quite simply, you give $100 million to every infantry battalion, for example, to go and buy toys that the DIH.
And they buy the small, the smart, and the many, and it's a ruthless market for success.
Yeah, and but you can easily deploy capital into this space to show you're doing something. So that to me was a political fix for a problem that people identify. It wasn't wasted. It was actually it's what we need to do. So it's not exactly wasted.
Well, that's exactly what we need to do. And the other point you've made is that actually it's the small and the fast, the small, the smart, the many is what Australian companies are good at. So we should stop thinking, well, how do we build big clunky frigates that take 10 or more years to build. The sweet spot for Australian companies is the faster, smaller stuff.
Yeah, it's easier for us. You know, I think about that Chinese flotilla did that sort of joyride around Australia back before the election. One of our supporters, actually, a fantastic chap, Vivu Tran, who was a business guy, one is now involved with Black Sky Aerospace. He did a great LinkedIn post about, I had no idea about the Chinese Navy, to be honest, but that cruiser that accompanied that, I think they called it a destroyer. Goddamn, it was a cruiser.
It was a cruiser. Yeah. It was more heavily armed than three of our future Hunter frigates combined. That single ship.
The future ones, yeah. So it had 112 VLS tubes on it, the Type 55 Renhai class. And the Australian surface fleet, if it could put to the water, had 208.
Yep.
So I'm like, so in that note, I don't think we can, and that was what, that was like the 12th ship of a 16 ship class, I want to say.
Yeah, so, and they're building fast. Like they pop those things out almost as fast as the Japanese are popping out their Megamis. The Japanese are building two of those things a year. Yeah, and we're taking 14 years. That's one of the general purpose frigate that's a competitor for the program. They're building two of those a year. It's taking us 14 years to build the first Hunter frigate. So we're just... Wow. The only way to get mass for the Australian military is with this market approach with the small, the smart, the many that you're talking about.
But there's also strategic frameworks we can fit into. So the US Admiral in charge of the defence of Taiwan. But
the Indo-PACOM, the Indo-PACOM commander or the 7th Fleet commander?
I think it was Indo-PACOM commander. He talked about turning Taiwan straight into an unmanned hellscape, for example.
Yes.
So he is, and that's a strategic, that's what they're doing. They're literally going to litter that water with that much lethality. It's incredible. Now, we need to do that on the approaches to Australia as well. So we can fit into that strategy. And we actually have that. You mentioned C2, for example. They have the
C2 amazing. Robotics. Yeah.
A bunch of other awesome stuff out there that could do just as well. So we can actually do this if we just have...
We can. We're going to have to end because I know your time's valuable. We're almost out of time. But the other thing I heard you mention in our chat beforehand is... Also, the idea of commoditization of stuff. And so not necessarily using the same old small bespoke military supply chains to make stuff, but actually looking at what your broader economy can make.
Yeah, I think it was in comment too, so around drones. I think drones are a fantastic comment, and I think they're an investment nightmare. They've been commoditized, that everyone's got a drone, they're exceptionally cheap. There's no profit left in them to be a capitalist, to be honest. But in Australia, we have an amazing number of businesses who build the components for those, be they autopilots, drivetrains, modems, a whole. We have some of the world-leading companies in that space. It's really quite refreshing. That's a sign of the commoditization, what I call the democratization of fires. So, you know, right now, the grubby Ukrainian corporal in the trench with mud on his boots has access to more deep strike capability than probably a colonel during the Cold War.
Yeah, which is an incredible shift.
Amazing shift. Yeah, and we need to get in front of that one big time. We can do that. So what's made these things cheap is commoditization. Software's got a large part to do with that, to be honest. And so you've seen the likes of the Andrels of the world and the Shield AI.
Yep.
We're talking about all the hardware they're building is merely just being like the wedge to put at the door for their software.
Yes. Yeah, the software is the thing and the hardware just wraps around it. Yeah, yeah.
And so you think a lot of software-enabled solutions, you're seeing AI will play more of a dominant role in there, you know. Pathetic attempts to try and ban and put treaties around AI will work as well as a treaty for landmines worked, excuse me.
Well, my view is that genie's out of the box. And I was talking with someone today about this. Remember mobile phones. So the government approach to mobile phones, particularly in national security, was you can't have a mobile phone. Don't bring it to work. And then everyone had mobile phones. So you can bring it to work, but not if you work somewhere that's top secret. And then cameras started to appear on phones. They said, you cannot have a mobile phone with a camera on it. And then when you couldn't buy a mobile phone without a camera, the policy changed to, well, you can have mobile phones with a camera. The AI is the same, isn't it? At the moment, it's an interesting add-on to products you buy. Shortly, if you would like to buy software, it's going to be AI-enabled. It's going to be baked in. You will not be able to turn it off. So that's the path that we're on. Yeah, well, Steve, I think this has actually been far more optimistic than I was even hoping. I think the fact you're bringing private money and business experience to this problem, and you're clear-eyed about where the actual market is, it's in the allied space and then back into Australia. But also, you've got the view of what Australians and Australian companies can actually do and how it can make this more secure in a dangerous world. So it's been my pleasure to talk with you. And in fact, I'd love to have you on in a little while when some of these ventures have come off and we can talk about some of those.
Yeah. I'd love to. Anytime. That'd be great.
Thanks, Steve. Great to talk with you.